Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Well, welcome to the first of our summer specials.
I think thank you.
In previous years, what we've done during the summer is we've saved up some of the live episodes that we've recorded. Now, obviously, because of lockdown, we haven't done any live episodes for these past few months. So we thought we'd do something a bit different. And for the next 4 weeks, you're going to be able to hear extended chats with people we were just interested to talk to. So coming up, you will hear Alistair Campbell, who is going to be talking about a new autobiography, kind of about his mental health that he's written. That's very good indeed. And he speaks in a really interesting and engaging way about this.
You're going to be hearing from a really interesting author called Wendy Liu, who was the founder of a tech startup and now wants us to abolish Silicon Valley.
One that you've already had sort of a sneak preview of is Lem Sisse, amazing.
A tease.
Yeah, you've had a little tease. He's an amazing poet, and we had a long chat with him about his story about being having his name taken away, being taken away from his mother, and his subsequent, you know, decades of trying to make sense of his own life and his own story, and he is so brilliant. So you'll be able to hear
and
that.
We just thought it was such a good conversation, didn't we, that we thought it merited a summer episode.
Yeah, the sort of 10 minutes you heard on the podcast wasn't enough. And this week we are starting with comedian Sarah Pascoe, who is somewhat of the polymath, I think. She's a brilliant stand-up. She also has a new programme, a sitcom, coming out on, I think, the BBC later this year. Her last book was called Animal, the Autobiography of a Female Body, and she has a new one. It came out a few months ago. It's now out in paperback. It's called Sex, Power, Money. And I sat down to have a good old conversation with Sarah about the book and everything else.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Sarah Pascoe, hello.
Hello.
Well, welcome back. It occurred to me that you were pretty, well, fairly much the first comedian we had on the podcast when we started. I think you were the top of our list, and then we thought we'd better just try it a couple of times so we don't waste Sarah's time. But as soon as we realised it was passable, you were there, you were first on our wish list, so it's lovely to have you back.
It's lovely to be back.
Well, as you can see, Ed isn't here.
Oh, have you sacked Ed? Have you fallen out like the Beatles? You've gone solo.
Yeah, we just paste his bits in separately. Yeah. We can't be in the same room together. Well, we can't.
Is he in your bubble or no?
He's no, not in your bubble. Oh. I tried to broach the subject with him, but he managed to shut it down in that politician kind of way quite quickly. He was having none
of
it.
Really?
Yeah. Did you have the experience of inviting somebody to be in your bubble?
What I've had actually, which is why I asked, is a couple of work things, because people are starting to film again and they're doing it in a very, very careful way. So I've had people ask me if if a celebrity is by any chance in my bubble. Like, hi, we'd love to have you on this BBC One show, da, 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 da. I don't suppose Chesney Hawkes is in your bubble. And then you'd go, no, actually, would you mind? Because actually, if you do 2 weeks, you can change who's in your bubble. And like, they have these, like, and it's like for their rules.
You have a format there. You could pitch celebrity bubbles.
Do you know what? Also, because work is so low on the ground, people would say yes. People would say yes to that. I'm going to pitch it.
I know you mentioned work and you've been recording a new series, Out of Her Mind. Is it a sitcom or is it a dramedy?
It's a sitcom. It's very much a sitcom. And but we'd finished filming before the lockdown. So we'd finished at the end of January. So we were in what they call post-production, which meant I wasn't really involved. And then that had to all then be done from everyone's homes by themselves. So it's taken a bit longer, but it could happen. So we're really lucky.
Yeah, and really, because a lot of people had started filming things.
I was going to say, Tim Key has just... they'd filmed, it's the guys who wrote, I think the Gibbon brothers who wrote Alan Partridge. So they've written this amazing series like about the Witchfinder General, and Tim Key's the main part. They filmed one day and then got shut down. And that just must be so frustrating.
How awful. I wonder if we're going to see these shows where people have sort of ravaged, there's continuity errors where people are ravaged by age.
And or just put on loads of weight. Like I've put on a lot of weight in lockdown, like walking 12 steps a day and everything. And I think that's what would be funny with continuity. If they start filming again and people are 2 stone heavier.
We're going to talk about the book mainly today, which is Sex, Power, Money. I think came out in hardback like a year ago at this point. I can't quite remember.
Yeah, exactly a year ago.
For people who've managed to elude them so far. Do you just want to tell us?
Were you careful how you were phrasing that? People who didn't want to read it when it was a hardback and £12. Why might they want to read it now? It's £8.
But people, I tell you, I do a lot of my reading in the horizontal position, and I find it difficult to read a hardback whilst lying down.
Jeff, what I hate is how hardbacks don't fit nicely with your other books on a shelf.
Yes.
So they end up clustering them together. And sometimes now, I'm very lucky, I get sometimes sent people's books before they're released, and they're the weirdest sizes, and I love the book, and then I think, I'm going to have to buy it again when it's a reasonable size.
That's why they do it.
Yeah, that's why they do it, because they get you twice. They get you twice with the book size.
So it's a paperback. We know it's coming out in paperback. Very readable.
Very readable. Perfect shape. It's going to fit in the pocket of your rucksack nicely.
So for people who haven't read it so far, like, what is it and why did you write it?
Well, so, Jeff, when we spoke before, all that time ago, it was about my first book. And actually, this book really... really came out of it, because in my first book I was researching the female body, how it's treated in culture, and I was planning to write a chapter on pornography in that book, and what I'd plotted out for that chapter was, I'll watch a couple of pornographies, I'll talk about the fetishization of the female body, I'll talk about how it may be damaging for women's self-esteem, da da da. So I started writing that chapter, and what I found out was I know absolutely nothing about porn. I hadn't watched it. Everything I thought I knew was from feminism. And then I realised this is far bigger than a chapter. I can't just slot this in. I'm not right. Also, I had these kind of understandings like, porn just shows all of this perfect type of female body. And then when I watched it, I realised that's not true at all, that there's an actual... there's a lot of diversity in pornography in all of the body shapes. So then I was like, it's so much more complicated than I realised. And so that's what Sex, Power, Money is. It's me going into the very complicated areas where I think I'd got to my mid to late 30s with lots of assumptions about things. And not just assumptions, as in strong opinions based on assumptions that were wrong. So I researched sex work and pornography, and it's not a polemic, and it's not... like a feminist book, in like it's a feminist argument. In lots of ways, it's not very feminist, because I'm not kind of towing the party line with some of the things that I discovered. But yeah, that's what it is. It's about porn and sex work, which is why you haven't seen me much on the BBC promoting it.
I want to get into some of those specific areas that you cover in a little while, and porn will be one of them. But just as you were talking then, I thought about, as as a teenager, when I saw pornography, a video for the first time, I felt it's almost like my brain had been poisoned. I don't know if I would have identified it at that time, but every time I closed my eyes, like
oh, it was seared upon your brain.
Images would come in there.
Yeah.
Did you find that sort of happened to you as you started researching it for the book?
Oh, that's a very well, the first time I saw pornography, that's what happened. And it's a bit like, I think of like if you've never watched a horror movie, something else that I haven't done is that actually your brain is so receptive. So that's what happened to me. I was 19 at a party and someone put on a porn video behind me and I hadn't realized. So when I turned around, it was just a close up of like mashing genitals. And it had so much it had such a big effect on me because I'd never seen it before. So it seemed so brutal and psychopathic. And then the next day was September the 11th. And so it all got mixed together in my brain because obviously that was such a kind of phallic thing, these planes flying into buildings. These two things became these like this like mush of trauma in my brain. So first, when I started watching porn, and I was watching like the tube sites like Pornhub. And if you have no history on Pornhub or any of those sites, they don't show you like horrible stuff. Like they don't show you the worst things, the internet, and we all know that it's there. They show you very innocuous stuff like stepmom seduces stepson. And I don't know, I think one of the first ones I watched was like a taxi driver who always had sex with his passengers rather than them paying their fare. And actually what I thought was, oh, it's actually quite, these things are quite like vanilla in terms of like sexual terms. It was all, I know it's hard.
Although it's surprising to see how much step families play into it.
Well, I guess that's what I found so fascinating is the idea of either power dynamics is a big part of sexual fantasy. So stuff that in real life is completely unacceptable, like sleeping with family members, blood relations or not, or like teacher student or babysitter, dad driving her home. I thought that people enjoy the experience. They enjoy the idea of it in a fantasy world because it's illicit. That is part of sexuality. And so that's why I suddenly realised it was much more complicated, because people might have fantasies that make them feel like a bad person unless we talk more about sex and masturbation and pornography in a way which isn't just stop watching it. It's taking advantage of people.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about that. I just want to sort of just carry on framing what the book is and you know, so how you've written it. Like one of the first things I'm struck by, and this applied to your last book as well, is just how dense it is in terms of the amount of research and then the way that it's punctuated with jokes or funny. Not that the funny ever feels like it shouldn't be in there. Is that something you're conscious of? Oh, people think of me this way, they used to be making them laugh, so I've got to give them, you know, every paragraph, every other sentence a little bit of something.
I think, like most people who have been drawn to comedy, but actually not exclusively that, lots of people have this in real life, I feel uncomfortable being too serious for too long. I actually feel a bit embarrassed when I'm being very earnest or very, you know, if I feel I'm being lectury or I'm just actually going, here's my opinion, here's my objective or subjective truth, I always want to kind of undermine it a little bit. And so, and I think the beautiful thing about jokes is choosing when you do use them and then choosing when not to, like just less. And that's something you can do in books that you can't do in stand up. You can't just go, and actually, I'm just going to leave that there without a joke. I just wanted to say it.
I think it's
go
to
home.
Your credit that you understand that you can't do that in stand up, because I'm not sure it's common to everybody in your profession.
Oh, it really is. The audience will be outside stage door going, why are we agitated? We're supposed to have had a nice cathartic laugh.
And just on that, like, just, I mean, I really, you know, as I've told you before, I love your stand-up. I think it's so good. And what is the trick? Because you're presenting a lot of information and often some kind of thesis as well. What is the trick? And you do it so well in the book. What is the trick to doing that without it seeming preachy at all?
I would say it's the layers of drafts, right? Because the first time you write something, it quite often is very preachy. When I first started doing Hours, the two stand-ups I most liked to watch previewing their shows were Josie Long and Bridget Christie. And the reason was because in the month before Edinburgh, they absolutely transformed. And both of them always had an agenda of what they wanted to say. And the last thing they added was the humour and the jokes. So actually, if you saw a preview 3 or 4 weeks beforehand in a pub, you'd kind of go, I mean, it's amazing what they're saying, but I mean, it was hard going. And then you watch them in Edinburgh, especially like Bridget's feminism show. The reason it was so brilliant is because it was absolutely packed with comedy, but underneath it was this strong framework of what she was communicating. And a book's a bit like that, where first of all, work out what you want to say, and then afterwards, you can add in the other flavours, including humour. But you have to know what you're going to say first. Otherwise, no one's going to stay with you through an argument if you don't know what you're saying.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Let's talk about some of the specific things you write about in the book. Now, early on, this is interesting. You talk about the contrast between all the stuff that came up in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election with Donald Trump and grab them by the pussy, and about how that fails to stop him being elected, and contrast that with Neil Kinnock, sort of.
Oh, yeah, you know, falling over.
Yeah.
Yeah, because obviously a third of the book is about power. That for me was such an interesting parallel. It was listening to someone, I think it was Naomi Klein. I know it was Naomi Klein talking on a podcast about Donald Trump. And obviously because she'd written about brands in No Logo, what she really understands is that, you know, that kind of saying about how no publicity is bad publicity. She was comparing Donald Trump to Marmite because she said, the amazing Marmite campaign about how some people hate Marmite made Marmite stronger. It didn't halve their sales as people realised, yeah, I don't even like it. And she was saying that about Donald Trump. She was explaining that his background is in wrestling, where a baddie gets stronger and you can't fight a baddie by saying, well, actually, they're bad. You need a goodie who's equally strong. She said all of the criticism just feeds into him and makes him stronger. And then she had this thing about the grabbing by the pussy was a demonstration of how powerful he is. People are really used to, like, powerful men. Again, I'm putting it in quotation marks. Powerful men transgressing sexually in all different kinds of ways. And people imagine that it's harmless. Like, I don't know if you've read it yet, but Curtis Sittenfeld's novel, Rodham, about what would have happened if Hillary Clinton hadn't married Bill Clinton. And it's so interesting because when in the novel, when Bill Clinton is first accused of forcing himself on a woman, lots and lots of women, because in this book, he's a bit more of a player. He becomes a tech billionaire and he has all these marriages because he's not with Hillary. And lots of women are like, oh, I wouldn't mind getting molested by him. And I think there's an element where people kind of think it's a joke because the celebrity is a cartoon. No one thinks that they're real. And actually, for that real person in the room with them, there is no, it's not a fun, silly thing that happened to them. But people have an idea that it's not that serious. I don't think people thought the grabbing by the pussy thing was that serious.
One thing I really enjoyed about the book is that you mentioned it. earlier, is that you find, I don't know if calling them inconvenient truths is the right thing, but because you're looking at it very much on a biological and anthropological level, you find some things that don't necessarily fit in with the way that we as good liberals want to see the world. And I can't remember exactly when you mentioned it, but you mentioned some battle-worn feminist tearing her hair out with you at maybe a book reading or a gig.
Oh, yeah.
Because you start talking about hormones and behavior being influenced.
Yes, it's very unfashionable, and some people, it's very unfashionable because it's not prescriptive. So it's not like human beings do this because X happened or Y happened, and then what people find it is either reductive, as in, don't you dare tell me I'm an ape who's doing things for evolved reasons, or they go, how unhelpful it is to the world.
In a more personal way, I think something you seem to, I hate using the word journey, but like a journey you go on, is understanding male behavior that you have experienced in your life, in family and relationships, just moving through life as a woman, understanding, if not forgiving, that through the prism of biology.
Yeah, it is. It's trying to understand things. And but then I think that's what life is anyway. I think that's why we read fiction. That's why we watch TV programs all the time. The most satisfying thing is trying to understand what's going on in someone else's head and why they do certain things. I think even in Sex, Power, Money, where I feel like, oh, I'm really learning to forgive male behaviour, I've still had some quite upset male readers who go, well, how dare you expect this of me or say this? And I felt like I was kind of really trying to premise it with like, oh, I know that because of some of my experiences, I came to this book quite sexist about men. I could be quite dismissive of men, or again, reductive about their behavior. What I was trying to do is understand it without saying that all men do it, because actually it's such a small amount of men, for instance, who like would flash or would like go up to a stranger at a bus stop and start hassling them for a conversation. It's such a small amount of men. And it's not fair to go, God, men, just keep it in your pants. Let's live our lives. Yeah.
So I'm interested that you've got men who've taken time to read the book and then take umbrage at it. I understand people coming at you if they've seen you on a panel show. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I understand it, but that makes more sense to me.
Well, you do, like, you do. And actually, it's quite a very small minority. And you do wonder if they have actually read it, or if they've just read a section of it, or they've heard about it. I did. I had a short section of it serialized in the Times, and that's actually where most of it came from. So, for instance, and I'll give you an idea, Jeff, because you know what the internet's like, so you've experienced it yourself firsthand. But what I'd have is, from that Times article, I had a lot of men saying, "You're so ugly, no one would harass you. Stop lying." And I realized, oh, something about the fact that women talk about this really touches a nerve with them. And it must come from a place where they haven't seen it, or they think we make it up, or they think, yeah, it would only happen to supermodels. It wouldn't happen to normal women. And I just think, oh, they just want an excuse to write a nasty thing to you. Because that's also part of it, is sometimes people just want to find a thing to say.
We did an episode on, you know, some online behaviours and how you tackle hate online a while ago. And, you know, something that got me thinking about, I think Ed mentioned it in the episode, was that level of hate or whatever, that need to get that bile out, was that always there, or has the accessibility of people like yourself and politicians and so on on the internet, has that sort of, has it festered because of that in some way?
I think it was always there. I think what's odd is that the actual person reads it sometimes. But do you remember, Jeff, in the 90s and the 2000s, there used to be a thing that if you went to a pub and you'd ever been on telly, some guy would come up to you and go, "He reckons you're a comedian." "I don't know you. I don't know you. Who are you? Why don't I be funny then, if you're a comedian?" Yeah. He says, and the mate who said it doesn't like you either. What's happened is you've come in and he's gone, "I saw her on that thing. And then they don't believe it. And then they have no respect for you. It's so rude. And I just think that's what the internet is now. They're going, oh, well, you're on telly. Think you're a bit special, do you? Think you're magic?
I know you touched on this, but let's talk about it a bit more. Where, when you started writing the book and porn was going to be this big element of it, where your attitude was towards it at that time and where you've ended up and how you got there?
Well, I think morally, I haven't had that big of a journey. I still think I'm quite a prude. I still think there's lots of situations where porn, in terms of individuals, can be damaging. And I don't necessarily, I mean, in terms of relationships, I think there can be jealousy issues. I think there can be privacy issues. I think we haven't yet learned to really have really good dialogues with our partners about what arouses them that isn't us, those kind of things, if we're monogamous. So we were all lied to about relationships. We were told that you'd meet a person and that is the person that you'd be attracted to and that would be the most beautiful thing in the world. But sexuality goes out in lots of directions. So it might physically only be between yourself and one other person for a long period of time. But that doesn't mean what you think about, what you get turned on by, is only ever going towards them. What really changed is I understood the economics of porn more. I think that people should pay for the porn that they watch, and I think they should be better consumers of it. And I think by doing that, you actually get rid of a lot of those problems that you're worried about going on in terms of coercion. I think the fact that people think they should get porn for free is really problematic. And I think it's really connected to shame. So that was for me. And I didn't know that's what I was going to end up with. It's like, oh, it's all economic, like everything. We live in a capitalist society and people should be paid for the work that they do.
You mentioned sort of morality, and I know that was something that you sort of wrestled with your attitudes to not just pornography but sex work.
So, oh yeah,
talk to me about sort of, because I know a lot of the conversations you had researching the book and in the book were about the subject. Where do you think you are on that now?
Well, the first thing that I realised, and it might be true for a lot of your listeners as well, is that I realised that everything I'd ever heard about sex work had never been from a sex worker. I'd read some things like that were from an ex-sex worker. So, but in terms of like someone who it is actually how they earn money now, I'd never listened. And I think that's one of the things that can be very, even with the internet and podcasts and all of the different varieties that we can absorb other people's truths, I had never ever had that experience. So my first thing was that, again, it's really economic. Let's say you're trying to protect somebody, or you know, for instance, you know, there's awful things, you know, that sex workers are murdered at a much higher rate than anyone else in society. So you think that they're vulnerable. You think they're vulnerable because they might be exploited by a trafficker, or they might be exploited because they are very, very, they're vulnerable because they're poor. You know, like there was horrible things that I was researching, like sex for rent, where men advertise and they advertise for women to live with them, but they pay their rent by having sex with them twice a week and things like that, which is something which doesn't feel like a choice, does it? It doesn't feel like sex work. It feels like there's someone who is desperate, or in some situations could be desperate. And what I realised, all of those things come down to money. Like you can't say, I think that I'm going to put all of the people who do that, all the men who do that, in prison. That doesn't solve the problem of, like, where's that woman going to live, and how is she? So everything kept coming back to the same thing. And I realised that a lot of my moral opinions when I spoke to sex workers were incredibly patronising. So I talk about this a lot, but the very first person I spoke to, I'd spoken to her just after I'd read an online article shared on Facebook about how in Sweden they were doing an exit strategy, which is where sex workers were going to work in old people's homes. And the article said, it's so amazing because sex workers aren't grossed out by the human body. So they're actually wonderful nurses for older people. And I told her this, like, guess what? I've solved it. Exit strategy, old people's home. And she was like, do you know how patronising that is? I earn £200 an hour. Am I going to earn that in the old people's home? I was like, oh, I don't know what they're paying people. And she said, you just offered me a job at £7 an hour. And I was like, okay. And then she explained, she was very kind. She wasn't actually being aggressive, but she was politely dealing with a stupid person, me. She explained that she earns £200 an hour, which means she can take on three clients. She has three clients who are regulars who she'll see a couple of times a month, and that's enough for her to pay her rent and live on. And so she was explaining that, and she goes, now talk to me again about an exit strategy. And so you go, oh, we're having a money conversation, not a sex conversation. And so that was the biggest change for me.
And how do you get around the fact that there isn't a sort of a monolithic experience of a sex worker, and that, you know, somebody, you're writing a book, there's only a fairly finite number of people you will have the time and resource to talk to, and it's this subject around which there's a lot of stigma.
Well, that's it. So the stigma from all the different directions only makes people's lives worse. That stigma doesn't help anybody. It doesn't actually put anyone off from becoming a sex worker. It actually makes them more vulnerable, more dangerous. Laws that try and make sex work more difficult always push sex workers into having being more vulnerable, because their punters are scared of being caught. So there's all these things that I didn't understand. When I did a podcast series for the hardback, and I'm doing another one for the paperback, because what I realized actually was that I couldn't talk on anyone's behalf. All I wanted to do was platform certain people that when I met them, I found their take so interesting, and I didn't want to transcribe it and put it in my book like it was mine. I just thought, I just want you to talk for yourself, because that's what I realized is you can't solve it. You just have to have a much, much bigger conversation, because I really, really thought I was educated on these topics. I really thought, like, and then I realized, oh, I'm so ignorant. And like, I did feminism in my degree. I really thought I'd covered these topics. And so people can be very well-meaning and very ignorant, really.
And you know, because you are a strong feminist voice in the conversation through your books, through your act, did you find that the book was in any way controversial in the context of the feminist conversation?
Well, actually, one of the things that happened with the podcast is some of the people I read are anti-pornography feminists, and there was and I asked people to come and talk to me on the podcast, because then I thought I'll have a range. Like, one of the people I'm talking to is a woman who is a director of porn, and then I'll talk to an anti-pornography, and not because I wanted to debate her, because the majority of things she says I completely agree with. Like, in my heart and soul, I believe, like, I can't help it, in my body I'm like, oh, but it must be horrible to have sex with someone for money. But that's a really unuseful thing for me to think for anyone's life. But I absolutely like agree with her. And she wouldn't come and talk to me when she got sent a copy of the book and cancelled it and said no. And then we asked some other people and they all said no. And then I realised, well, this is the thing about a binary argument, like pushing someone into, but it's a grey area, isn't it, is not helpful. Like, it's very similar with what's going on, actually, in terms of debating trans women's rights. And I don't think it should be a debate, because essentially you're saying some people shouldn't have human rights, but the discussion is so complicated. It's complicated by people saying things that seem very empathetical. Is that the right word? They seem to be really reasonable, and that's why trans women shouldn't be allowed in the toilets, and that's why refugees have to be, and they're proposed as in full of heart and kindness. And then other people don't understand why it seems like a sector of the internet are going, shut that person down, they're saying such a dangerous thing. But it's short. They're defending women in refuges. How can that be the enemy? And it's a very similar thing going on, but actually it's a much longer discussion than a tweet, how we support sex workers better, while also being anti-trafficking and anti-exploitation and all of those things. It's like, you can do those both things.
I should let you go. Before I do, just a couple of things. I'd noticed that, you know, we know each other a bit in real life, and I've talked to you in this context.
I saw you in the park the other day,
Jeff.
You
did see me in the park the other day.
How's Gene getting on with his bicycle?
He's completely able to cycle now. I think it's weird. Oh, he's four. Like, what age did you learn to ride a bike?
Oh, much older than that, but I didn't have a bike. Not a sob story, Jeff. I didn't have a bike till I was 25. No, I think I learned it around 7 or 8. I got my first bicycle.
But these kids are all four. They're learning that. It's very strange to me.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of things as I was reading up, you know, the book and some of the interviews you've done around it that I didn't know about you that I wanted to ask about. The first one is, you are a diary keeper, a habitual diary keeper.
Oh, I used to be. When I started stand-up, I used to be up until about, I'd say, 8 years ago. I still have a thing, do you know, like the artist's way? I still sometimes do pages, which is a bit like a diary. But
which is a thing that creative people do to splurge stuff out to get started, right?
Yeah, it's a mind dump or something, but it's a very useful way for anyone who either, I think I described it to my husband, like it's like a massage where you find where the knots are in your brain. You've got, oh, you've got a bit there. So pages is spontaneous writing. And it's the most useful thing. I've never done the artist's way, but because I've had friends who've done it. If you're feeling creatively blocked, because quite often that can be emotional, but it's just speed writing where you don't edit yourself and it doesn't mean anything. And it comes out quite a lot like a diary. You often start with, I'm sitting here, the sun is shining, I had a cup of tea, I feel awful, so sad, should have a bath. Washing up, like, and it starts off with like that, yeah. But I always, always kept a diary from being a child. And then I think that's where stand-up happened, was that stand-up became my diary. And right. That's why my stand-up's so confessional, is that the things I was writing down and going on, rather than me just dear diarying them, I then had like a, hey, Balaam, how you all doing? My boyfriend jumped me. I fancy Stuart. He hasn't texted me back.
And then the other thing, and I couldn't believe this hadn't come up before, is you had worked as a backing singer for Robbie Williams' dad.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, this must have been, because of how old you are, this must have been Robbie Williams' dad having a crack at a revived show business career off the back of Robbie's fame, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. So it's really interesting, actually. So Pete Conway was always a singer. He's always a singer. That's why Robbie is a singer. And so it wasn't in any way like a stab at success. We all worked in a Warner Holidays hotel, which is for older people. Do you know the hotel chain? It's for over 50s. It's cruise-style dining and entertainment, but okay. You don't have to leave. And then, yeah, we had guest entertainers, and every day they got like a cabaret show, which is what I was doing.
Oh, okay. I was imagining he was sort of having a second crack of the whip because of renewed interest in his son.
Well, actually, it was so sweet because every time the guests changed over, you watched the same rumour go through the hotel as someone found out, he's only Robbie Williams' dad, and then passing it all around. And within 3 days, he was getting people coming up going, just tell him I love Angels. I'm going to have it played at my funeral. I think he's beautiful. I think he's... Guy Chambers is the brains, but I'll tell him...
Sarah, it's always like just a joy to chat to you. The book is tremendous, and now that it's in paperback,
so much more comfortable,
physically comfortable to read. The book is Sex, Power, Money. Sarah Pascoe, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Bye bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers, and if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.